You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. If he dies, he dies.
I was wondering how long it would take you to get to Dolph.
Lundgren, man. Dolph Lundgren, dude. Rocky IV, the Russian. Let me tell you something. If you haven't seen Rocky IV, you should, because it's a legendary movie, and he played legendary Ivan Drago. The dude was a chemical engineer. He's a smart dude. We rubbed Honest Hemp Balm on each other. Not on each other. I put Honest Balm on my neck. He put it on his ankle. We had a bonding moment. He got, you know, he really enjoyed, I could tell he really was enjoying the interview. And I like that. I like that when people actually have fun. Like, I'm a people pleaser, as you know. And Mia is here with me. Mia, in case I'm going to say it again, Mia is a trans woman. If you ever in the past heard me refer to Tyler, our engineer / podcast, Rob's not here, but Mia is.
Right. Or in the future, some of those episodes haven't aired yet either.
Right.
Yeah.
That's true. If you hear the word Tyler, it's Mia.
Hey, guys.
Just so you know. Anyway, Dolph Lundgren talks about, gosh, I mean, so many things. I mean, Grace Jones.
Yeah.
You know, going out with Grace Jones and their relationship and going to the dance clubs. And
you don't expect Ivan Drago to have so much insight about life. Like, he has so much to say about his career and the way that his life has been. And it's incredible.
Not only that, but he helps me. There were just things that he said that was very profound about how we act as an adolescent. He really didn't learn a lot until he was in his 40s. He goes, I really didn't get it. Anyway, you guys are going to love this one. Let's get inside Dolph Lundgren.
It's my point of view. You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio audience.
Yeah, right?
I like it.
Do you you sound like Sly.
Hey.
Did you do a Sly?
Hey, Dove, you like this knife? Fucking great, right?
You hang out with him all the time, don't you?
Yeah, I like Stallone. He's a nice guy and, you know, smart guy. And we're just friends. We've done, what, 6 films together. So
what, Expendables 1, 2, Rocky 3, 4, 3?
3 Expendables, 3. Rocky 4.
Masters of the Universe.
No, Creed 2.
Creed 2.
So what is that, 5? 5 films.
Jesus. So what does he do? He's like, yo, Dolph, you know, I thought you might want to do this. You're like, are you going to pay me, you cheap bastard? Is that what the conversation is?
No. We have some similarities, even though he's from Italian stock. I'm from Sweden, blonde. He's, you know, Italian, dark. But there's something similar because we both did sports and we both had, I think, similar upbringing in some ways. And that's why I think we get along on another level somehow, on a deeper level, just not to business or acting, you know.
Yeah, because you're both smart. Like, I read about you. I didn't know how you, like, studied chemical engineering. Here's the reality. When people watch Expendables, Rocky IV, all your action movies, you've worked with, you know, people look at you and go, I doubt he's a chemical engineer. They think, you know, they look at me, I'm an actor. They probably think, oh, this guy's an idiot. He dropped out of school. He just memorized his lines. But you know what
he's
I'm saying?
He's a moron.
He's a moron.
But like Sly would say.
He's a moron.
He's a moron.
Are people usually shocked when they hear you say that? Because you're an educated guy.
Well, some people are. I mean, a lot of people know it by now. It took 35 years. But a lot of people know that I did engineering. And they're a bit surprised, I guess, why, you know, how you would go from one to the other. But, yeah, I don't play a lot of chemical engineers in the movies. I don't think there are a lot of scripts written for engineers or playing an engineer, maybe a nuclear physicist or something. I was thinking about it, actually. There's a play about Niels Bohr, who was a physicist, you know, in the 30s, and he actually helped the Nazis were trying to fabricate a bomb, and so it was the Americans, and he actually helped to kind of hold the German effort back by talking to a German nuclear physicist, and he met him in like 1940 or something like that in Denmark. Denmark was occupied by the Germans. Anyway, there's a play about it, which is quite interesting. And he was about my age at the time, so I always thought it'd be kind of a shocker to show up as Niels Bohr, you know.
To play him?
Play him. Yeah, why
that
not?
Would
I mean,
be dope.
I did study engineering, so I would understand what they're talking about. But it's not.
You should have been in Chernobyl. Did you see the Chernobyl TV show?
I saw it, yeah.
I could see you playing one of those guys.
Yeah, but I did play like Russian, so maybe I'll go for a Dane for a change.
Yeah, Dane, right? Yeah. That's what you want to play.
Actually, he wrote the letter to Einstein that kind of alerted Einstein, who lived in America at the time, because he was running away from the Nazis. Alerted him about the fact that there was a way to split the atom to create this incredible energy. And then Einstein wrote a letter to Roosevelt.
Right.
And that's the letter that started off the Manhattan Project. So that's kind of what the play is about, which is quite interesting because it changed the history.
And does it get to the Enola Gay taking the bombs too?
Not in the play.
Not
kind of hard to do that on
stage.
It's
hard to do. Yeah,
but,
yeah right.
I have to reread it, but it's more about him and his wife, about Niels Bohr and his wife, and this German who came to Copenhagen, and he was running Hitler's program, but somehow Bohr got to him. So after the war, they realized that he'd helped to hold the Germans back,
right.
Hold their program back.
All right, now I think you're just bragging, like because first the chemical engineering, but now history. So we're going to go to every subject. We're going to see how much you know.
Well, look, I think it is about engineering. I realize now as I get older that I think I just wanted to squeeze a lot of out of life. You know, I was in engineering and then I ended up doing sports, ended up, you know, working kind of, as you know, as an actor, you work with your emotions and your, the kind of interior of yourself and your more of a psychological, emotional work. So, yeah, I'm trying to just see what else there is to do because, you know, life is quite short and, you know, I just want to get a full experience.
Well, that's what I'm looking. You know, you go on the Wikipedia and you go all over the internet and you see all these things about you. I was blown away that how much adversity you faced along with how much you've done. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And that was, and I think that's what I was really drawn is that, you know, growing up wasn't the easiest thing for you. And I think a lot of people can relate to that. A lot of people had tough childhoods. And, you know, when you think yours is bad, then you hear another story and that's worse than yours. And, you know, the idea is to grow up and try to get over it, make your own life, be a better father, be a better whatever. And so that's what, like, it hit me. It's like, this is a guy who faced a lot of shit, man, as a kid. And it's like, how do you get through that? How do you tell another kid who's going through shit out there, like, you can get through this?
I don't know. I mean, I had to work on it myself first. I wasn't ready to help other people because I was suffering from my own trauma from my childhood up until about five, six years ago, really.
So, really?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, I think I developed PTSD because my dad was very violent, right? So when you live in an environment where you're not safe, where you feel threatened, like a soldier on the battlefield, you may die any day, you develop PTSD, you know, and then you, what happens is, I did this TED talk about it, actually, something called escape syndrome, where you try to escape that feeling that's inside you by drinking or having sexual encounters, affairs, violence, some people go through self-mutilations, things like that, but I think I escaped it by being involved in contact sports, you know, hockey, and then, of course, martial arts, karate, boxing. And then as an actor, you can escape it too. You can hijack it and use it. But it doesn't mean, if you hijack, it doesn't mean that you get rid of it. It can still run your life.
Yeah, but what about, like, when you say you went to combat sports, was that because in your head you're like, I got to get stronger and bigger so I could beat the shit out of my dad?
Yeah.
Was that what you were thinking?
Well, I think so. I don't think if I plan to beat the shit out of him, I don't know, but I plan to not get hurt again, not let it happen again. So by the time I started it, I was about 13, and my dad had already kicked me out of the house to my grandparents, because I think at a certain age, even if you beat a kid who's 7, that's one thing. If you beat somebody who's 13, 14, the boy is becoming a man or a young man, and it becomes a different deal. Becomes a little more, I think, a little scarier for the guy who beats a boy at that age,
because
he can hit back, or you have to hit him harder, and maybe you'll hurt him. Maybe you'll really hurt him, which I don't think he wanted to really hurt me. He just wanted to take his own frustration out, you know.
I mean, you called yourself a runt, though. I look at you now, you're 6'5". You're like, what are you, 230, 240?
Yeah, 230.
I mean, you're in perfect shape.
Uh-huh.
I'm not hitting on you, dog.
No.
I mean, you're a handsome
guy.
Okay,
it's okay.
I'm just saying, I'm looking at you, and I'm like going, how old are you?
61. So
how do you do it though?
Well, that's, well, part of it was probably, I was very driven as a kid and I, you know, worked out a lot and I was trying to, I realized karate was, you know, good for me. I was a very good fighter. I had that killer instinct, you know, when I got hurt, it made me better, you know, because you either fight or flight. So I would turn, if I got hurt, I would let the opponent hurt me a bit. Usually I would try.
That got you going?
Mm-hmm.
So you want to be hit so you can get mad?
Yeah. Well,
what?
You don't really get mad as, you don't get mad, it just comes like a feeling of survival that takes over. That gives you an extra energy push. Doesn't mean you hate the person. It just means like you can overcome them and you can beat them.
So you're not one of those guys that likes to go out swinging. You're like the guy that gets hit and then goes, so wait a minute, are you saying that Dolph Lundgren is kind of like Ivan Drago?
Because Drago. I mean, did he want to get hit?
I don't want to jump to that, but I'm just saying, you know, he can get hit, but then he just goes after it. It makes him more mad. He just gets more ferocious.
No, yeah, in one way. I don't know. I was always, I think I was the only kid who arrived at the dojo with a briefcase, you know, dressed in a shirt and tie, you know, from school, you know, from college, from engineering school. So obviously I used it as some kind of relief of my emotional state. It wasn't like I wanted to be a champion. That just happened.
Were you popular in high school?
I was getting kind of popular as I got better in karate, because usually doing well in physics and chemistry doesn't help you much with the chicks, you know.
It doesn't.
And I didn't realize that. I was very, very shy with girls. I still am, sort of thing. But I was very shy. I didn't have a girlfriend until I was about 20. Well, not really until I met Grace, Grace Jones, when I was about 25.
That was your first girlfriend?
Well,
you
real,
had sex
real girlfriend.
Before then.
Yeah, I did. Yes, I did.
Yeah, thanks for filling us
bad,
in on that.
Bad attempts at it, you know.
Well, I still have those bad attempts. I mean, I'm not always. In fact, I apologize. I'll just say,
I used to too, yeah.
It was so fast. Compliments to you.
Yeah, well, mine wasn't mine weren't even that good, so it was not as successful as that.
Well, that's good. You're at least admitting that you're not perfect.
That's true, yeah. I think that's what drives people forward, that you have an inside feeling of yourself that you're not perfect, and that's what makes you... Well,
I think that's what hinders me, actually. Like, my biggest thing is...
You're perfect.
No.
I don't think I'm perfect.
No, I really, here's the thing. I try to.
That will be back anyway.
You can do them all. Can you do all the impressions? You do Schwarzenegger, you do Stallone.
Well, I can do this guy, you know.
Wow, Michael. Is this a Rando?
Yeah, that's all. Yeah.
All right, real quick, if you do impressions, I'll be you.
No.
You be Stallone.
No, I don't want to do them too much. I already did it.
But wow, you're good at that.
Yeah.
We'll
get back to it.
But what was I saying? I was just saying that, like, my problem is, and I'm going to this retreat, this, like, mental retreat for 3 weeks, because my problem is that I'm just talking about it openly, as I always do.
Yeah.
But I always feel like if I'm not perfect at something, and look, I know perfection is a fantasy, I fail. If I go out there and everybody's laughing when I'm doing stand-up and I kill it, I walk off and I'm thinking, oh, that one guy didn't do it. I wasn't good enough. For some reason, I'm so hard on myself. And I know that it's got to stem from a lot of, you know, not getting approval as a kid, what kind of resonated when we first started talking, you said it wasn't until about 5 years ago or something that you kind of dealt with a lot of this shit.
Yeah.
Which kind of gives me hope. So I was like almost happy to hear because I'm 47, going on 47, and I'm thinking, I got to get clear my mind of this stuff because I'm getting too old for it. But like, it affects you not only psychologically, but physiologically. I think things.
Especially,
How did things come out physically for you that were all mental, like sort of related?
Well, I think, you know, when you're younger, you're much more resilient emotionally. Your immune system and your nervous system is much stronger, so you can take much more damage, you know, and pressure and self-doubt and things like that. But as you get older, you know, naturally you get more
fatigued.
You get more vulnerable. You have to look for some kind of spiritual path as you get older to support you in that way. So I started meditating and I started doing psychotherapy because I had a divorce and because I was drinking too much. I was just messing around, you know, being unfaithful and basically screwing up my family life because that stuff started hitting me, you know, and escape. You're trying to escape, but it's in here. So I had to deal with it inside me. And my new girlfriend kind of knew that something was wrong. And I knew I was going to end up losing her as well, unless I did something. So first I started meditating. I got this little DVD and I started the CD and started listening to it. And then, you know, got more and more into it and I started reading about it. And then now I meditate between 30 minutes and an hour, depending on.
You do it every day.
Every day.
You don't miss it.
No. And the other thing is then I got into psychotherapy and then I realized, you know, this PTSD, which was kind of running my life, and which I had used to become a fighter and somehow an action star, which I didn't know, okay, that just happened to me. You know, I didn't plan that. Then I kind of worked on that a little bit and I kind of, you know, got over some of those ailments. And
What does psychotherapy do?
What does it do?
Yeah.
Well, in my case, it makes you, you go back and relive those experiences where, in my case, as a young boy, I was faced with you have three choices if you get attacked physically, fight, flight, or there's a third one called freeze. And if you can't fight back and you can't run away because you're at home and you can't fight your dad because he's too big, then it's called freeze, which means that it's like an animal, if a lion's taking an antelope, just when it's about to attack it, the antelope, just if you see in these videos, it just kind of goes dead, right? Because one, he wants not to suffer, and two, sometimes the predator will leave it alone if it's not fighting back. So that happens to people too. So if you can't fight back and you can't run away, you know, your body just goes dead, and you kind of, all the emotion, all the energy is stored inside, and then you try to get rid of it. But by reliving that experience 50 years later, in a different way, you can get out of it. They do it in a certain way, that type of therapy, where you actually end each session on a positive note. So after a while, that negative energy kind of dissolves like a piece of ice or whatever in your chest, and then it doesn't run your life anymore. So you can make decisions from, you know, from what's happening in front of you instead of what you went through. Because a lot of people make decisions not from what's in front of them, it's from something that was done to them, you know, 50 years ago.
You really swear by psychotherapy.
I do.
Now, after this is over, can you give me a number of someone?
Yeah.
You could.
Yeah.
Someone in L.A.
Yeah.
And now, what happens when I go in there? Like, let's say our first session and you're my psychotherapist. I could tell you're already looking at me like, yeah, you are fucked up. You're looking at me like, I could tell you got some shit going on.
You know what David Mamet said? Nobody with a happy childhood ever went into show business.
You know what's funny? I always get so true, right? I mean, because you have something to draw from.
Well, you have
something to draw from.
I'm pleased that my dad had a crazy side. I wouldn't be sitting here. I wouldn't have made all those films or wouldn't have won any, you know, trophies or anything, probably.
I feel the same way. I feel like, you know, again, your childhood sounds like it was.
It wasn't terrible. It wasn't, you know, I wasn't in concentration camp. It was
right.
It was just, you know, it was damaging to some degree.
Was it psychological, like I love you and then hit you? Was it those or he never
told
you?
Well, he never said I love you, but he would say, you know, you want your parents' approval. And when somebody that you love, because everybody loves their parents, hurts you physically, it's you blame yourself. And then you end up blaming yourself, and then you end up thinking you're not good enough, and that will, you know, influence how you do things later in life.
You said something really important, man. You just said, I know we're getting deep, but I like this, dude. I like that you're getting deep on this.
Yeah, I'm used to it.
You're used to it?
No, I like it. As you can tell, this is my...
Yeah, I love this shit.
This is my hobby right
and
now.
And by the way, Katie is your friend. She's been working for you forever, right?
Yeah.
And she's amazing. Hi, Katie.
Yeah, she's amazing.
She and I met in New York, and I remember she took me to the Grammys one time. She was working for Diana Ross, and I thought we're going to, like, sit in the back row. And next thing I know, we're picking up Diana Ross in the limo. We're hanging out with Ray Charles and, like, all these people. I'm wearing this crazy, whacked-out Elvis suit. So thank you, Katie, for getting, you know, Dolph here. You're a hero.
Ray Charles, look at those guys. I mean, look at what the shit that those guys went through.
Jesus, yeah.
Yeah, well, you got one guy there, for instance. I was never a heroin addict, or I wasn't blind, you know, so I didn't have those things to overcome.
I mean, you were, yeah, that's true. I mean, you were lucky because, I mean, you got size.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, don't know if that's good. I mean, it's hard to find clothes.
Do you hurt? Does your body hurt from all the work you've done? It has to hurt.
Yeah.
It's a stupid question because
no,
the karate.
It does. It does.
What do you do for pain?
You know, it hurts, yeah, occasionally, depending how much I train and if I do any crazy stunts, it gets worse. But, you know, I take painkillers sometimes or, you know, anti-inflammatories.
Like a Norco every once in a while?
Not that much. No, mostly like anti-inflammatories and Advil and sometimes stronger stuff, but not that much.
Yeah. I just took a Norco about an hour
ago. Well, because you had some...
neck surgery. Yeah.
Yeah, surgery.
Yeah. I'm doing all right, though. I'm down to one a week. One a day.
One a day.
No, sorry, that's a big difference.
I've been on that stuff.
You have?
Yeah, I've been on, what's the strong one?
Oxycontin. I wasn't on that.
I've done that. I didn't like that one. It was, you know, it just made me sick.
My dad makes them. He's manufactured. He worked for Watson. Not illegally. He worked for Watson Laboratories, and he manufactured the most, he's manufactured more Oxycontin than anybody in the history of the world.
Should.
Yeah, that's what he did. He was a plant manager. He's like, he goes over to China and helps them figure out their plants and stuff.
There's a morphine based, isn't it?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I'll call my dad right now.
No, morphine because I had some hip surgery before I had the surgery, I had this incredible cramp. I mean, I had this incredible pain. I went into ER and they gave me a shot of morphine, I think it was. And that was pretty nice.
That's good.
Yeah, it was good stuff.
Yeah, it's amazing how, like, the only thing I'm addicted to, I've had seven surgeries, but what I love is, I know it sounds like I'm an addict, and I'm not. I'm a control freak. I don't want to be out of control, so I don't like to, like, I don't have an addictive personality. But when they put me under, I always say, listen, let me at least enjoy it for 10 minutes, 5 minutes. So my assistant was filming me all fucked up. So it's me, and they're going, I just want some applesauce. That's all I want is some applesauce. And I'm telling you, for those 10 minutes, though, there's no feeling like that. But you get addicted to that shit, there's no life.
Yeah.
I mean, you're done.
That's true. Yeah, look at a lot of artists and, you know, Elvis Presley or Jackson or whatever it was, they were all into painkillers.
Yeah.
It wasn't like drugs like cocaine or whatever it was. Yeah.
It's heroin.
Trying to come down.
Yeah, it was Hendrix, Joplin, Morrison, all those guys. It's all
too
heroin.
Much. Reality was just too much for them, I think, because they're too sensitive and there's too much going on, too much fame and too much money and, you know, attention and love and,
You said something like when you're younger, you have so much energy and resilience and your immune system's strong and all this stuff. Mm. And that hit home. That's what I was, one of the points I was trying to get through a little while ago, is that that's what I feel like. I felt like no matter how stressed, no matter how, you have a meeting here, you got to go audition for this big TV show. You have 2 hours to learn this. You have this. You're on set every day, 14 hours. And I could do it, even though I was still fear-based and scared and trying to get the confidence and I'd find it, you know, eventually. I had enough energy in the tank for some reason for so many years. And then I hit about 43. And that's when I started to go, oh my God, I got to do something because I can't handle this. I don't know if I hid a lot of certain things as a child or certain things growing up that I just kind of like put deep down and kept there. Sometimes I feel like everything surfaced, like my life isn't like, what's the purpose? Like I have a great career. I'm very lucky. I have a house. I have great friends. I have all these things. But sometimes I feel like I'm going through the motions. And that's when I notice something's a little off. I sort of disconnected. Did you go through a stage where you were really depressed and then you had so much fame that you forgot about it, or it numbed everything where you just forgot about it and then all of a sudden it caught up to you?
Do you want to lay on the couch and I'll sit over there? Anyway.
I'm telling you. Well, you know what? This helps me. This is what this show is, by the way. This becomes therapy for me. I'm glad to hear this shit. You're helping people, Dolph.
I'll start with you. No,
I love it.
Well, it's like if you're sick, if you have a toothache, it'd be better to go to the dentist. You can stay at home. You can try to put some needles in there and wash your mouth with salt water. At some point, you got to go and see a dentist, or you're going to be in a lot of pain. And it's just people have this adversary to psychotherapy. It's something bad, but it's not really. It's just talking to a guy who's a specialist in those type of problems. And then you can have somebody listening and maybe give you some good advice of how to get out of it.
Have you done hypnotherapy? They put you to sleep. I'm always look. The good thing is I'm proactive. I'm always looking for something to, you know, I'm learning to meditate. The thing is, I think it's consistency. I think if you just go, oh, you know what? I'll meditate today. I think, you, like you said, you do it every day.
A little bit.
Have structure in your life, right? Do you have structure?
Very much so. It's the only thing that keeps me sane, because my business, as you know, is like the old days. You used to have the wagon and then they travel from town to town and you perform over here and then you go over there. And, you know, it's like in the old Shakespeare days. It's the same now. You just got to travel to South Africa for 4 months. Then you're in Australia for 4 months. Then you come home for 3 weeks. Then you're in Philly for 3 months. And then suddenly a year passed and you're like, shit.
Are you just telling me your life just now?
Well, that was my last year. That's what it was. So I was gone for 8-9 months last year. But it was kind of a special year. It was good for me film-wise, but it was tough. Family and just for my own nervous system, because when you're not sleeping in your own bed, you never feel like really relaxed. You can't quite relax, you know.
Do you ever get anxiety?
Yeah.
Still?
Every day. You kidding me? That's the reason I meditate.
You just sounded like Stallone. Every day.
Every fucking day.
Every fucking day.
Every day. You know, every day in the morning, I get up and I meditate, hopefully. I mean, preferably, I try to do it right before sunrise or right around sunrise. And all the anxiety from the previous day, business, family, health, all of those issues that I think most people deal with, they hit you when you sit still. Because we're not used to being in the domain of being without sleeping. Domain of doing is like sitting around here talking or training or whatever. And then we go to sleep, then we wake up and we do things all day. But you sit there with your own body and your own thoughts and feelings and not do anything. That's kind of an enlightening. You realize who you really are. You're not your thoughts. You're something else, you know.
You know what? It's hard, I know, for a lot of people listening, but I'll tell you what, dude. It's hard for people to imagine. Even me, who does, like, believe in it, even though I haven't really immersed myself into it as much as I should, like you have. But I feel like this is the idea. The idea that, you know, you're going to wake up in the morning and, you know, I feel anxious, so I'm going to sit here and I'm going to meditate for 20 minutes and I'm going to breathe and then I'm going to wake up, I'm going to have it just doesn't sound like that's going to work, being in your mind, in your own head that you're trying to get out of. But it's something about being present. It's something about, like, I don't know, just when you can kind of go blank, when you can kind of get rid of all the noise.
Being mindful, it's called.
Being mindful, mindfulness.
Mindfulness, seeing the true nature of existence, because you're not thinking, you're not trying to do things, you're not trying to analyze too much, and just kind of be there and be the observer of everything. That's kind of feeling a relief not to have to think and try to plan things all the time and keep up with change, because change, it goes so fast you can't keep up with it. So
right.
You just don't even try for a while, at least for half hour during the day, or maybe 20 minutes, it's 3 minutes or whatever.
What's the worst anxiety attack you ever had?
I don't know. When I got divorced, it was pretty bad, because you think your kids are suffering. And I had these anxiety attacks. I'd be sleeping. I couldn't. That's kind of what got me into meditating and stuff. And psychotherapy is, when you wake up, realize you've effed up and fucked up, like, your whole family, and it was my fault. It wasn't all my fault, but I'd blame myself for a lot of it. And that was bad. I remember that was really bad.
Like not being able to breathe.
If you're going to break up, usually I don't have bad things, relationship with my kids, but like my girlfriend, if we have a huge fight, like we broke up for a year, and that was anxiety, you know, like the emotional pain is probably the worst.
And obsessing over it? Did you obsess over it?
Yeah.
Because, I got to talk to her. I got to text her. She's got to.
Yeah.
Trying to have control.
No, I'm never going to see her again. I'm never going to see this person again, but I'm sure anxiety. I mean, I read the Dalai Lama quite a bit when I, you know, on and off. And he has like one book that's like 365 pages of advice, one for each day of the year. I could read a little bit before I go to, I usually read before I go to sleep. But I mean, basically it says in Buddhism, they start preparing you for death early on by meditating. So in other words, it's not an alien concept for them. And there's no suffering involved. Less suffering. I mean, on the path
right.
to get there. Because that's at the bottom of most human suffering, is because we know we're going to die, you know. And that, so it's all anxiety kind of, I think, comes from that.
Are you afraid of dying?
Yeah, like everybody. I don't want to die either. But on the other hand, like to say, if somebody said you could live for 1,000 years, you probably would commit suicide long before then anyway.
Yeah, because you don't want to see all your friends and family die.
No, you don't want to see all
your kids, right?
No,
who wants to see that shit?
So it is just a matter of how can you live reasonably happily every day and not think about it too much, or at least, you know, not worry about it that much, I guess.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
Judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
I saw a picture of you holding up Grace Jones from way back in the day.
Yeah.
And you said happy birthday, I think it was.
Yes. Yeah. She just turned, she was her birthday.
She just turned 30?
Yeah, 35.
35.
3 days ago.
And you were a bouncer at a club, or you became her bodyguard?
Yeah, I was a bouncer in Australia, in Sydney, Australia. I was studying engineering at the school there, and University of Sydney. And I ran into her. Because I did security at rock concerts, and she was one of them. So I was picked out to be like her personal security afterward, me and two of my friends. And of course, she had seen me, so she was the one to pick me out.
She hit on you?
She didn't realize that. Yeah, I figured it out sort of late at night when we were up in a hotel suite and people started leaving, and pretty soon it was just her and me left.
Really?
I was like,
and were you very attracted to her at this point?
I get it. Okay.
And you were into it?
Well, I was. Yeah, I was attracted to
How
her.
Old was she at the time?
Well, I was about 24, and probably she was about 30 or 29, 30.
And so you guys obviously had sex that night.
Yes.
I mean, what year was this?
82.
I mean, look, here you are. You are a
bouncer.
I was
late for class.
You're a guy at a concert. Right, you're listening to some concert. You think, "Oh, I'm going to have the little radio, and I'm going to fucking sit here with a bunch of other guys." And next thing you know, Grace Jones is hitting on you.
Yeah,
and then you have how long did you date? 5 years?
4 years. We were together for 4 years. After that,
was that tough? Was it a great relationship? Love and craziness.
It was love and craziness. Yeah, it was. You know, I came to New York and I was going to study at MIT in Boston, and I had a degree already, but I had 6 months off, so I came to New York and ended up going to 54 and running into Andy Warhol, Michael Jackson, all of these people, and, you know, and all the craziness that went with it, because this is right before AIDS.
Right.
They said it was a period between contraception becoming kind of, accepted, and the onset of AIDS. It was about 10 years, I guess, when things got a little crazy.
So you effed as much as you could eff.
Pretty much. Well, I was together with her.
God,
but then
wouldn't it be great to eff and not worry about effing?
Exactly. Well, that's what it was like at 54. Like they said, I saw that documentary that was just out called Studio 54. It's really good, you know. In those days, said, like, once you were let in, because, you know, there was a little guy who picked you out, Mark, whatever his name was, that bouncer, a famous little good-looking guy. Anyway, once you got in, you could do anything you wanted.
Anything.
Anything. Nobody cared. No, and there was no, like, oh, you know, the fire department going to show up, or like, oh, the cops are there's like undercover cops in here. No, there were none of that.
I have a vision. I picture you.
But I wasn't that crazy.
Was your shirt off? Were you dancing, sweating?
But
I knew it.
But I used to go and run. We lived in the West Village. I used to go for a run at 5 in the morning, no matter whatever. I mean, if I'd been up till 4:30, I'd still go for a run. So
you were disciplined then.
I was disciplined, yeah, a lot.
Wow.
And I wasn't doing drugs or anything like that. So
did you meet Andy Warhol?
Yeah.
Like, what would he say? Oh, hi.
He said,
I just really.
Hi, what are you famous for?
What'd you say?
Nothing. As far as I know, he said, I'm going to put you in my magazine.
Did he say that?
Yeah.
Was he hitting on you?
A little bit. Yeah. Then they did a photo shoot, and I found out afterwards that there was a bet between him and the photographer. They get him to take all my clothes off, which I didn't do it.
Did you get some of your clothes off?
Well, sure. Yeah, I got my shirt off. I was used to it.
Dolph, would you mind? Or were you Hans then?
Hans.
You were Hans back
then? Yeah.
Hans, can you just take your shirt off? Please?
Andy would like to see it.
Would like to see it. That would have been just a, oh my God, what a treat. You really lived a life, man.
Yeah, it was cool. And I remember being at the, because I was sitting with my daughter and, you know, the advertising comes on for, you know, buy the DVD for the Motown 25th anniversary concert where, you know, Michael Jackson did them for his moonwalk and Diana Ross was there. And there's like a musical on Broadway about it called Motown. So I told Ida, my daughter, hey, I was there actually. I remember I was there with Grace Jones watching the whole thing. And it's like, you were there? Yeah.
Wow.
And Michael Jackson came on and I said, what's the big deal with this kid, you know? And she's like, don't ever say that about Michael Jackson. He's the most talented guy ever. He's going to be a huge star. I was like, all right, sure, whatever, Grace. Yeah, sure, whatever. And she was right, because then the Thriller came out and then he was a huge star, you know?
Wow. Man, you've been around, dude.
Yeah.
From Grace, like, you weren't thinking at this time, I want to be an actor.
No.
How'd that happen? Because you were modeling, you started doing that?
I was modeling a little bit because I wanted to get an H-1, they call it like a work visa. And then I was doing karate and had some friends in New York that were, you know, I was already a karate champion. So they said, yeah, man, hey, man, you know, you could be in the movies, you can fight, you look good, you know, you should try to study some acting.
So what is that, like 82 after you just won?
83.
Right.
And then I, you know, found this acting coach through Grace who helped her on the Bond movie. She did the Bond film with
Roger
Moore. Yeah.
Do you remember the Duran Duran song?
Oh, yeah.
Let me hear you sing it. Missing you.
No.
Was a view to a kid. Wasn't that it?
Yeah, but it was a little more upbeat than that.
I forgot how it was.
I remember the opening, and it was wrong. Chris Walken. Chris Walken was the bad guy, and
bad.
He was bad. Yeah, Dolph. And then I was in San Francisco for the premiere, and I was training with Stallone at the time for Rocky IV, and you know, I told him, yeah, can I get some time off from training and go for, you know, because he knew Grace. He knew us with Grace. And
who knew Grace?
Well, he knew that I was with Grace because I was living in here in Los Angeles and she was staying with me a little bit. And he said, forget the Bond movies, you know, wait till this picture opens, you know. So like, I didn't realize he was right. I mean, obviously the Rocky thing was just a really big deal.
Well, I mean, I hear that. Is this right? Because my story is that 700 actors auditioned for the part that I got, Lex Luthor. But I hear 5,000 actors auditioned for Ivan Drago. Is it Ivan Drago, right?
Yeah, I think so. That's what Stallone told me. I mean, I was in his office when I first met him. And
he auditioned you?
Well, he started. Well, what happened was I went up into New York for a cast, for like a cattle call. And, you know, it was like hundreds of guys there. And I just came up to this table and there's a woman sitting there and, you know, for a boxing movie, I didn't know what it was. And then she just said, well, how tall are you? And I said, 6'4". And she's like, too tall, next. And I'm like, hang on a minute. And I looked behind her and there was a sign saying Rocky IV, like handwritten. So I said, oh shit, a Rocky movie. So then I took some pictures because I was a fighter. So I knew all the Rocky. I mean, Rocky III was I loved Rocky III with Mr. T and all of that. Oh, so yeah. I took some pictures of myself in boxing gear and I sent them through my acting coach, who was actually somebody who sort of knew Burt Young. He knew Burt Young, who was a friend of
Paulie.
Paulie, yeah. Paulie. So Paulie gave my photos to John Hertzfeld, who's a good friend of Stallone's, actually one of his best friends, director. And that guy gave them to Sly. So about 6 months later, they flew me into LA. I was in Europe at the time. Some PA called me, oh, thank God I found you. You know, I've been looking for you for months. Stallone's going to kill me, whatever it was. So he found me, and then they flew me in, and I met Stallone. He had long hair. He was going to do Rambo 2.
What did he say to you, the first thing he said?
I can't remember what I said. He said, you know, you got to put on some weight. And he's like, I
took
some Polaroids. And he had, yeah, I got 5,000 guys up for this role. So he had all of these, you know, this is before computers, so they had all of these binders with 8x10s everywhere around the whole room.
Hey, could you take your shirt off? Your pants?
I was used to that part.
My buddy Andy Warhol's here. He wants to talk to you.
So we took some Polaroids, and then I had to do a real audition 6 months later, like a real screen test.
What was that like? Were you nervous?
Yeah, I was. Well, I'd worked on the character a lot, and I was in really good shape, and I'd worked on the monologue, and I decided to keep it very internal and not to yell too much or, you know, because I studied these, looked at these Soviet officer cadets, where they still with their chin up. Like, they have a certain look to it, you know, chin up, kind of proud, you know, hero of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And they flew me into L.A., and I'm in this hotel, some cheap hotel, and go down to have breakfast because I knew, you know, this audition is coming up. And I didn't want to eat more than half a piece of toast because it was all ripped, you know. I didn't want to put on any weight. And the elevator opens, and there's like a 6'5" blonde guy looking at me.
Oh.
Good morning. And then whatever. There's some other dude down there, and I'm like, oh, shit, okay. So there was three of us. So
did you think you were going to get it, or are you like, I'm not going to get this?
I didn't know.
This guy actually has a Russian accent.
I was pretty confident because I knew I'd really worked on it. But it was nerve-wracking because they had in those days, you know, it was a dolly track and one camera, 35, going down the track towards me. Here's my mark and in my shorts, no shirt. And there's about 50 people behind the camera, Sly and his bodyguards and a bunch of people in suits. And then I had to do this in one take of this monologue, which they used later in the teaser trailer, where it starts something like, my name is Drago. I'm a fighter from the Soviet Union. It starts like that. And then the camera creeps in, and it kind of comes around my boots first. You see the Soviet boots, and it goes up my thighs and comes up. Anyway, so I go back to
New York. I wanted to hear the rest of that monologue. I was in, man. You remembered it.
I fight the old champion.
You know, by the way, yeah. You probably get this. You know what the best part of that movie was? At the end, you kind of looked at him like,
yeah,
the good job. It was just in your eyes.
Yeah.
Like you looked at him like, hey, way to go.
Or but so, you know what it was. No, you know what it was the story. It was really the Frankenstein myth. It was the monster has been created by somebody else, Dr. Frankenstein. Yeah. It wasn't like Mr. T was just on his own out there kicking ass. It was, you know, it was the Soviets that created this guy. So you kind of felt sorry
for Drago. Your coach, your trainer, he was the bad guy. You were just the guy that was trying to do his job.
Yeah, that's it. So that's why I think
it was touching. You liked him right then. It was crazy how you can hate somebody and then love him.
Well, I think it kind of got me into having a career sort of as a leading man, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm playing a few villains here and there, but mostly as kind of a leading man, not just being stuck as that, you know, what it could have been. Even though it has... Of course, some people always remember, everybody will remember that character, but it's still, you know.
You still get residuals from Rocky IV?
Not much.
what's the most you get in a year? Maybe 10 grand?
Yeah, no, probably not even that. I don't know. I didn't make much money on that picture, but I didn't care because, you know.
It just brought you
superstardom. Yeah, it was a lot of money for me in those days, you know.
Yeah.
So I didn't care, really.
That's great, man. You know, Sly is, when I worked with Sly, he was just like, I had these dots all over my face.
Oh, what was that for?
It was for Guardians of the Galaxy, and I had a small part, but like, you know, my buddy, he's one of my best friends. He ended up giving me like four lines in the movie, like three scenes with Sly, and
yeah,
I had dots all over my face. And the first thing he said was like, hey, who are you supposed to be, Pepe Longstocking, with your dots all over your face? And like, he would do these things where I had line, and he was like looking up on the set, and he's like, look at this, they got rust? You'd think they would have learned how to lose rust, get rid of rust in the future. And then
he's
I saw,
a funny guy.
And then
yeah,
I had neck surgery, and we had like, I said something like about Sly to my surgeon. The surgeon goes, Sly's actually here. He's walking up right now. He just texted me because he's. So I go, I'll bring him in here. And he went in there, and we started talking about our necks and our pains. He's like, my fucking back. We had the same back surgeon. We just had this connection on set. He's such a funny guy.
He is. He's very funny.
He is. It's just
like
unbelievable.
Him. Yeah, I like him a lot. I mean, we got along. You know, he was my boss in many movies, and the last one now in Creed 2, you know, which he, you know, obviously it's his creation, the whole Rocky franchise, but now it's sort of Michael B. Jordan and the director, and, you know, MGM kind of runs the show, and he's more like an actor, you know, like I was an actor. And so we were kind of both actors on this film together, which was kind of nice for me especially, you know, where it was just mainly just working with him as an actor, not so much as yes, sir, and no, sir, you know, like a boss, like here's my...
So you had a good time?
I had a good time, really good time. Yeah, he's funny, like you said, he's a very humorous guy.
Do you ever go into jobs like, at this point, obviously, everybody's done this, but do you really have to like something? Or if you're like, wow, they're paying me a lot of money, I'll fucking just do it.
I'm fucking do it. No, I think that, no, I mean, recently I've actually been, it's gone the opposite. I've taken a lot of stuff just for money back in the, not only for money, but, you know, mostly for that purpose in the past. But now I think it has to do with being older and getting older and also thinking more about spiritual matters. Like, you know, I was really happy with Creed 2 because it's kind of about redemption and about forgiveness. And I got to play a father who's kind of cruel to his son, but he makes up at the end.
Wow.
And in Aquaman, I played a father to, you know, what's her name?
Mara.
Mara, yeah.
Kate Mara.
Mara,
no, which
no,
one?
Mara was, what's her
Mara
name?
Mara Servini? What the fuck?
No, Johnny Depp's ex-wife, Amber Heard. She was very nice. So I got to play her father, and I worried a lot about her, which I could relate to because of my daughter. So, you know, I think that I would rather do stuff where I feel there's some kind of purpose to it and some kind of positive message at the end of the... Well,
and can do that now.
I can, yeah, you know? I can. So I do that most... I have a couple of smaller movies I'm working on. They're all like that. I always try to twist it around so I can get some kind of positive, inspirational message in there somewhere.
I like
somewhere.
That. That's important.
Yeah, which is cool for me.
You ever cry in front of your daughters?
Yeah, too much.
You
they
do?
Hate it. They hate it.
What do you mean? What do you cry about? I want to hear this because I cry.
When did I cry? Last time I started sort of crying was... Last night, we were watching Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
You cried in Honey, I Shrunk
you
the Kids?
You know when the ant dies, the ant?
Yes.
When he dies, it's sort of sad, isn't it?
And you cried.
Well, I started, but it wasn't really full on. But
And the girls noticed?
Yeah, they know.
So they say, Dad, are you crying?
Yeah, I'm a very sensitive guy, you know.
I like that, man, because I cry, and sometimes I feel like, you know, I never saw my dad cry.
No,
you know, you know, my dad was never like, hey, I was like, Dad, I scored 3 goals in the hockey game. He's like, yeah, but there was a weak goalie. You know, he never heard him say, I love you. There was a lot of stuff like that. He was really hard. But here's the problem. My dad was also 6'5", 230 or whatever. Like, he's like you, and I was the smallest kid in my high school. I didn't grow till after high school.
Yeah.
So I was this little, really a little runt. But I, you know, I was always a crier. My dad was, I remember seeing a Broadway show at my parents. And if you had a camera and you went down the line, you'd see my little brother, who was my dad's, like, he was emulating. He always wanted to, you know, him and my dad were like the best of friends. In fact, one time my mom said in front of me, in front of everybody, come on, Mark, to my dad, everybody knows that Eric's your favorite. And I'm like,
oh, nice.
I'll never forget it. And my dad's like, come on, what do you, what, come on. But I knew it. She was just saying what I knew, but she shouldn't have fucking said it because she's psycho. I love my mom, but she's a fucking psychopath. You know, she's a fucking nutbag. She's been on Valium since she's 8. I love you, Mom, but fuck. So anyway.
She should have done some therapy. Would have been cheaper.
Jesus Christ. She needs it. But here's the thing. She lies so much, she believes her own lies. You can't talk to someone like that.
Well, look, the one thing in therapy, you realize everybody has their own story. So my dad, even though he was, you know, very violent and crazy in many ways, I understand that, but you know, he was a little boy at some point too, you know, and he got abused. Whatever the hell happened to him, I don't know. But I know someone like, I don't want to know because it was much worse than what happened to me.
And you just forgave him.
Probably the same with your mom. Yeah.
And I
forgave him.
I forgave. You have to forgive. I think that's the first step.
And I forgave. Actually, I asked when I first got divorced. Well, not first. After I got divorced and after I'd done therapy and realized kind of what had happened, because you come out of this fog going, shit, did I do all of that? What the hell? And you realize why you'd done it. So then I went back because my wife and kids at the time were in Spain. They're not here. I mean, my kids are here now, but my wife and kids, I lived in Spain for 10 years. So I went back and I saw them and I, you know, I told my kids, you know, that please forgive me for what I did, you know, and told them why I'd done it. And they started crying immediately.
Jesus.
So I realized that they had suffered a lot. And my wife, too, my ex-wife, she started crying also immediately. So it was really nice to be able to ask for forgiveness and not to just ask for it, not to justify, well, yeah, please forgive me, and I'm sorry I did that. But you know why I did it was because this and no, you guys said period at the end. Please forgive me. I shouldn't have done that, period.
Isn't that something? Because, you know, if you want to say I'm sorry to someone, there always has to be. It feels like, I'm sorry you feel that way, but that's not what I was saying.
No.
Instead of just saying, hey, I'm sorry I said that.
Really,
I'm
sorry. I fucked up, period.
I fucked up. I'm sorry.
That's
I apologize.
That's the best way. That's
but yeah, I had an ex-girlfriend who used to be like, I go, you know what? You're right. I'm wrong. She goes, shut up. I hate when you do that. But what I was saying, by the way, I was seeing a Broadway show with my family, and if you pan down, you'd see my brother just straight, like Ivan Drago, and then my dad, same thing. Then my mom hysterically crying, and then me crying, and my dad and
well,
my.
That's good. That's why you're an actor.
I know, man. But my dad, you see, like crying was just like, yeah.
Well, I would cry when I was younger, but I was embarrassed about it. But now I don't care. So. Because I know that it's good for my my career anyway to be close to my emotions. So I and at my late found kind of opportunity to do roles like that. It's I just embrace it that
you,
I am.
You
like
give
that.
Me. I'll tell you what, man. I'm really impressed with you, Dolph. I really am because look, you're a big dude. I didn't know you. I was like, fuck. I don't know what to talk about. Is he going to get pissed?
Steroids.
If I ask him about like you know
deadlift.
Personal shit. You know what? I didn't know. I didn't know. And like you're a hero to me and a lot of people. You know, I grew up in the. You know, I'm 46 and. You know, I watched you my whole life. He watched Masters of the Universe back in the day, and he was a fan and all the movies. And so the fact that you're so open, I'm telling you, is really helping me.
Thanks.
Because it's just like I feel like, you know, hey, now's the time. Like it's never too late to say, hey, look, I need to fix what I'm doing because it's not working.
Sure, man.
You know, I need more structure in my life. I need to do things for me. I can't always be the giver. You know, sometimes it's okay not to give everybody your time. I'm always so like, I hate disappointing people. Man, this has been awesome. I feel like I don't want to take more of your time. I feel like we really covered a lot of shit. What do you got going on? What else is going on? Because I see you're always doing something.
Well, I'm here now for a couple of weeks.
So you want to hang out maybe?
Yeah. I was in Italy doing a little movie and, yeah, I don't mind coming for a little. I mean, my girlfriend likes karaoke, so my daughter is here. So if you have a karaoke, let me know.
Hang on. You knew that ahead of time. I have a whole room downstairs. That screening room is a big screen. It's a karaoke room.
Okay.
It is 130.
You told me.
Yeah. I did. Yeah, I had to say it again. Sorry about that.
No. I'd like to come over. And
if you guys want to karaoke, I'll be your DJ for the night.
And I'll give you some advice regarding if you want to know about meditation and therapy. I know quite a bit about it now, so I can
point
you in the right direction. Even to do it by yourself, which is the way I do most of my meditation. I've been to one retreat, and that's it. I do it mostly on my own.
I love it. How often do you ever do these conventions where you sign autographs?
Yeah, I've done many of not many, maybe about 10. I like it actually. It's a bit tedious, but you get to meet the fans.
Yeah.
You know, face to face, which doesn't happen much anymore, and I like that.
Yeah, I do too. I just got back from one.
Where was
I? Was in Orlando.
Oh, that's a big one. I heard that.
And it was the first time that we had three big ones on the show were me, Clark Kent, and the girl, and it was the first time we were together since the show since I left in 2008. And it was crazy. It was just thousands of people. It was so much fun. And you just see it does put a tear in your eye to think, oh my God, these people, like they grew up with you. They had a connection with you. People in Iraq, like were like, hey, me and my platoon, we this is what got us. I'm like, wait, this is what got you. What? This show? Because I always think, oh, I'm an actor. Who cares?
Yeah.
And our jobs we're so lucky.
I agree. I used to think the exact same way. And then I it came to me like, why did I quit chemical engineering? Why did I do that? And I was just 27. And it was just like such a radical decision. But I think I wanted to make people feel good. And that's what I've done. Most of my fans come up with positive messages. And like you just said, and I think that's why I ended up doing this, to give back something to the world. And I think that's kind of the main reason I'm doing it now. And that it's kind of a nice way to think about it.
Doing
it for other people.
For other people. Do you have any fans who are just like, anybody ever piss you off and say something really mean to you?
Not much. No, very, very few times. Maybe when I did Rocky IV and I, because I killed that guy, Apollo Creed, the guy with the big mouth.
That you guy, know, yeah.
Yeah. So,
you know, they were upset with me, but you know, I didn't mean to.
Hit
I
him, was just Dolph. Really hit him, Dolph. Anyway, so
you know,
I.
Yeah. You know, I had a fan. I had a fan come
don't
up
worry
to me.
About it. Don't worry about it. All right.
Yeah. I had a fan come up to me, Dolph, and he goes, I just want to tell you that Gene Hackman was the best Lex Luthor ever. And I go, okay, great. Thanks.
Fuck
I know
you.
That. I'm well aware of that. He's my favorite. And he was like, all right. Well, I go, that's what you waited in line to tell me? And he's like, yeah, I just want to go, okay, well, great. Well, thank you.
No, I don't.
It's the weirdest thing.
I don't think I've had that. I mean, occasionally, maybe something that, you know, upsets me a little once in a while, but I usually don't. It doesn't affect me much anymore. Not that much anymore.
So you calm. Know? Well, listen, I'll tell you what. This has been a real treat for me. I think
just punch him in the face next time.
Just punch him.
Fuck you.
Well, this has been unbelievable. I think people are going to really love hearing this side.
Yes. Yes.
He's so fun. I could talk to him like this for fucking ever. I mean, you feel like a relative, a really tall, strong, handsome relative. We're not a very good-looking family, but you have a... It pisses me off when beautiful people have beautiful kids. Like, both your daughters are beautiful, right? How old are they? 20?
23 and 17. That's what I'm most proud of, that the kids turn out okay in this messed up business.
Right? It's hard, man. It's hard.
Yeah.
Well, hey, man, if you need honest hemp, some CBD oil or anything, man, I'll give you a big bunch of that shit. You use that stuff?
No, I hear it's good. What do you do with it?
This stuff, this is a balm you put on your... I'm like, show you, but...
Where do you put it?
On my neck, the back of my neck.
Is it good?
Yeah, it just gives me... It personally helps, inflammation. Yeah, man, here you go.
Can you eat it? No, I'm just kidding.
You know what? Yeah, well, you can. These drops, I'm going to give you some anyway. There's breath spray, there's drops. There's no THC. It's not going to fuck you up.
No.
But there's some tinctures you take and they reduce inflammation. Yeah, put a bunch of
shit. I had like...
Your ankle's swollen.
Yeah.
You're rubbing it on your ankle.
I had this... Well, because, you know, this guy, neighbor of mine, when I lived in this building here many years ago, came up to us and my girlfriend and said, hey, man, you got to try this shit. It's really good for your injuries. So there is these like little chocolate... Yeah, like little chocolates in there, right? And of course, some of them, he explained to me what it was. I don't know much about it. Some of them are... THC and the other ones, are, you know, whatever it was. And then, of course, my girlfriend goes, I'd like to try some of that. It's like, here you go. So she ate one of those little things. And it was, then I looked at the wrapper, it said nine doses.
What?
9 doses of THC.
Was she fucked?
She was totally
fucked. Was it hilarious?
It was. Well, let me tell you this. It was on a Saturday night. I had a couple of drinks. It was fun for about 20 minutes.
And then she, like.
Then it just crashed. Then she threw up for about 7 hours. It was great.
Well, hey, man, I want to thank you. Thank you for allowing me to be inside of you today.
Sure, man. Yeah.
And we'll take a picture and let you be on your way. It wasn't too bad, right?
No, it was great. I loved it. Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks, man. All right. Dolph Lundgren, folks.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone's senior writer, Brian Hyatt.
Now, here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you were only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band, and they must think this kid must have just handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.